All rise in the courtroom and to those listening on stream, for the dishonorable badger is entering the scene. Apparently doing this as a day job simply was not enough, so let your jaws drop to the floor, 'cause we can't make this stuff up. Welcome back to the Legal Funhouse. We put the fun in dysfunctional. It's crazy in the Legal Funhouse, but weirdly educational. But every single one is remarkably true. One of them went to law school and is more than qualified to talk about the strangest cases from the strangest people alive. And the friend that he brought along barely passed eighth grade, whose legal experience lies within parking in the fire lane. Welcome back to the Legal Funhouse. We're just as confused as you. It's finally time for the Legal Funhouse, and without further ado, every single one is remarkably true. It's Boozy's Legal Funhouse. It's Boozy's Legal Funhouse. It's Boozy's Legal Funhouse. It's Boozy's Legal Funhouse.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 30 of Boozy's Legal Funhouse, Cartoon Railway Negligence. I am your host, the Boozy Badger, Boozy Barrister, here with another fun delve into legal cases and the American jurisprudential system. Okay, it's time for the disclaimer that I normally at least get through the introductions before I have to remind everybody and inform new listeners of the fact that we record this live, and I am good old one take Boozy. I don't do a take two. I'm lazy. I hate editing. We did one live show and I had to fucking level correct everything, and after 4 fucking hours of that, it's just reaffirmed my desire to never have to edit audio again. So, you know what? If you want a quality show, make it so I can live off of doing this shit, and I'll hire an audio engineer and editor. There we go. That's the deal from me to you, our listeners. I am your host, the Boozy Badger. Boozy Badger. God damn it. Every time I burp right in the middle of my own name. This is like the 3rd time in a row I've done that. Here tonight with our co-host, the certified legal layman, Alkali Bismuth, as we go into yet another case that explains why the hell America's justice system, Jesus fuck, is as bad as it is. This has been a fucking week. I don't know if I could fuck up an intro more than I just did, but you know what? I'm gonna take it as a challenge, and next time we record, just gonna be gibberish. Just a solid hour of gibberish.
Look, dude, I think you're doing a great job. You may have had some flubs on the introduction, but your introduction did not get interrupted by an email that caused everyone to go outside for 4.5 hours. You're doing great.
There we go. In case if you're listening to this later, for this is a podcast, it is an audio format. Alkali and I are also, in addition to me being an attorney and him being a person who collects unemployment,
They killed that on me long time ago.
No. I've been a bum so long, they don't send me a check anymore.
They stopped that. They want it back.
Like they're like, you know what? You're not getting a job. We know this now. You've made no efforts.
Hey, I do stand up. That's a job in certain circles.
That was about what I was to say. Is Alkali and I are both comedians. We are both stand up and comedic performers. And last weekend, we were both performing at a convention in I always say in Detroit, but they're not in Detroit. They're in a suburb outside of Detroit.
Yeah,
I always love it when they do that. It's like, it's the Chicago Comic Con. Where's it at? Joliet.
Dude, I've had people tell me, yeah, I'm from Chicago. Oh, really? So am I. Where are you from? They're like, Milwaukee. I'm like, all right. All right, hold on.
I love the Chicago. It's slowly creeping.
We've got multiple states of the Indianapolis. Yeah, the suburb of Chicago, Indianapolis.
But we're at this event. We had performances that we were doing. You had a lot more than I did, which I've got to have words with that programming director, because they brought my ass out. They put me up. They gave me the highest level of registration, so I got free food and drinks, paid for my room, and then had me do like three fucking things. And I'm like, you know what? No. At some point, we got to recognize that while I enjoy the downtime, the performances are how I convince other places to bring me the fuck out and promote this shit right. I'm doing. And like, when I finally restock my merchandise, I will have merchandise to sell, and nobody's going to buy merchandise from the fat guy they don't know who he is. Like, there's a, well, you want to buy a t-shirt with my face on it? Just a fat guy smiling broadly at you.
And if I design your shirts, I'm totally smearing that. So it'll be a little fatter on the right than the left. You know, nice shirts, nice shirts.
So we're there, and it's opening. And the staff, the chairs, and the board members are up there telling everybody what a fun weekend they're going to have. And they're like, we've got a great weekend planned for you. And to tell you what a great weekend, let's hand it off to the director of programming. They hand them the mic, and they're like, yeah, we have a great. And then the chairman comes up and goes, we just received an email, and everyone needs to evacuate the venue. They got a bomb threat. like 2 seconds in to it going, they got a bomb threat.
Oh,
had to empty the place out. Everybody got sent to go stand on a golf course for 4 hours where people are like, you can't stand on the green. And I'm like, well, if you don't have a porta potty, I'm shitting in the litter box or in the sandbox over there. So like maybe pick your fucking battles, man. Pick your battles.
No shit, right?
I'm fat. I had a lot of coffee this morning, and there's a sand trap right there. Nobody will ever know, except for like the 1,000 people standing around the sand trap.
Hey, at least they didn't start a cult.
No, they did start a cult. It was actually a big deal.
Pine Shrine.
Anyways, if you have not listened to Boozy's Legal Funhouse tonight, there are two things that we have to do before every episode. One is I do need to read off the names of the Boozy's Legal Funhouse Patreon supporters over at patreon.com/lawyersandliquor. So a special thank you to Tez Cat Magic, Jag, Waylon DeRoche, Beaton Dozer, Trash Panda, Mama T, Uncle Kage, Evelyn Klein, Lisa Lupe, Lupus the Raccoon, Netherlinks, Pandemonium, Hawk, Petrov, Neutrino, Buddy Good Boy, CC Otter, Chroma Hydra, David Hunter, Dragor, Eddie the Weather Fox, Flat Fox, Ghost Goat, Grace Jane Gallagher, Head Fox, and Jason Knight, John Michael Carden, Julie Esslinger, Jess James Lack, Lorraine and Priere, Mark Whipple, Michael Blocker, Nikolai, Otto Poom, Red Fox, Scuba Fox, Seraphin Silver, Tekel the Dragon Show, Tiny Voices, and Ziggy. If you want to be one of those wonderful people, just head on over to patreon.com/lawyersandliquor and show me your support. Now, for the second part of this. Boozy's Legal Funhouse is an educational, informational, and hopefully entertaining discussion on law and legal principles. While I am a licensed attorney, I am not your attorney. Nothing I say should be construed as legal advice. The way that I would become your attorney is you come into my office, you discuss your legal matter with me, I agree to represent you, you sign an engagement letter and pay me a retainer of my choosing. You don't just get to PayPal me a buck and I'm your lawyer. And then you have legal counsel. That's how you would do it if I accepted public clients, but I don't. Outside of those very specific circumstances, no attorney-client privilege exists, and nothing you are going to hear tonight is legal advice. Please, for the love of God, do not go into a courtroom and say, a fat guy who pretends to be a cartoon badger on the internet told me this. It will not go in your favor.
What if they rip off their sports coat and they're wearing your shirt?
Yes,
the big blob that I've created. Then it's okay,
right? You caught it. That's the exception. That's
I
the
knew
one,
there was some legal exception.
That's the one single simple trip that prosecutors hate. You rip off your shirt in court and my face is on your chest. Doesn't even have to be a
shirt. He got me.
It doesn't even have to be a shirt. You can just tattoo my face directly on your chest. It's a get out of jail free card. By the way, this is what I mean when I say don't say a fat guy on the internet told me this was okay.
You can basically assume anything I say is wrong on this show, as you have proved over 30 episodes.
Well, yeah, you've been right sometimes.
When I was guessing.
Yeah, like, I didn't say frequently.
Okay, good.
I didn't say you're frequently correct. So we are recording this on...
Bob's watch is broken twice a day. It works.
So we are recording this on March the 31st, 2023. Which means that there is a major piece of legal news that occurred yesterday that we have to discuss before we get into today's case, right?
Yes, we do.
Alkali, what is that legal news?
Somebody got indicted.
No, Morgan & Morgan, the personal injury firm nationwide, has stated that they will stop giving common courtesies like continuances to insurance carriers.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
You got me. You got me.
Coming from the ABA Journal yesterday, March 30th, 2023. This is how lawyers think. It's like, yeah, Trump got indicted. But a personal injury firm has said they will stop agreeing to continuances as a courtesy. And that's the shit we're going to report on right now.
Okay, honestly, that's fair. Because last night I went deep diving and I tried to find more stuff on the indictment. And it might as well just have been a replay of everything they said prior to the indictment.
Right, exactly. So Morgan & Morgan, for people who are not aware, Morgan & Morgan is a national personal injury law firm. You've probably actually heard their ads that go something like, I'm John Morgan of Morgan & Morgan. I'm Matt Morgan of Morgan & Morgan. I'm Tammy Morgan of Morgan & Morgan. And Morgan & Morgan & Morgan & Morgan & Morgan. It's just Morgan's the fucking way down. All the fucking way down. They're a personal injury law firm. They originated in Florida. They've expanded nationwide. And after Republican Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed a sweeping tort reform measure, they have said that they will no longer agree to continuances, extensions, or other courtesies with insurance carriers and their attorneys during lawsuits.
So be it be there or be square from the compactor that compacted your body. Got it. Okay, fuck them.
Like the idea here is generally you have like common courtesies. Like I can't make a continuance. I've got a doctor's appointment. Or I can't make a hearing. I've got a doctor's appointment. Do you mind agreeing to continue? So a lot of times lawyers will be like, yeah, no, sure, that's fine. Or, you know, could you extend my response time frame by 5 days so I can get something out? Oh, yeah, sure, that's fine. Or I need 30 days to get answers back to your discovery, and we're coming up on the deadline. Is it cool if you give me an extension? Oh, yeah, that's fine. These are common courtesies in law.
Yeah, it sounds like professional courtesy. Yeah,
like, a lot of times if you object to it, there's a reason. There's a good reason. Like, you know, no, this is your eighth continuance. You know, shit like that.
What is it? We're no longer accepting good reasons?
So, but a lot of times, all you have to do is ask. All you have to do is be like, hey, I need this. And the other side's like, yeah, no, sure. The idea is like, you know, you're asking for it now, and that means when I ask for it later, you pretty much got to give it to me.
Yeah.
All right.
Unless you're an asshole.
Yeah, I mean, like, because if not, I'm going to bring up to the court how many times you've asked me for a continuance or an extension, and I've said yes. And the court's going to think you're an asshole and give it to me anyways. So it's like a professional courtesy thing.
Oh, so the court can still force a continuance.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. Of course.
Would the court force a continuance? Like, yeah, they're being assholes and I have a doctor's appointment?
You know, I can't go into my specific cases, but you know what I do for a living. Like you know what type of law I do.
Absolutely.
And you know where I am every single Thursday.
Absolutely.
And you know what I'm doing every single Thursday.
The webcam doesn't lie. By the way, I cammed you a while ago. You should find that.
So yesterday that actually happened. I called opposing counsel on a case, and I'm like, hey, I need a continuance. My witness can't make it. And he's like, nope, I'm going to object. And I'm going like, well, do you mind if I ask why? He's like, well, because I feel that it should be. I'm like, I've given you like 8 continuances in this fucking case. We're asking for one. He's like, nope, make a motion. I said, you know what? I'm not going to make a motion. We went to court, and essentially he's like, I'm objecting. I'm like, Your Honor, I understand he's objecting. However, we've given them 8 fucking continuances. We just need one. And the judge is like, really? Like, they'll lie on the record. The judge is like, really? No. Like, you know, department's request is granted. The matter's continued. Stop being a dick. Like, the last part was paraphrased, but, you know.
Yeah, but it's a good paraphrase. Right. The paraphrase that I would have wanted to hear.
So, anyways, Ron DeSantis signs a tort reform measure. And what a tort reform measure does is, like, it limits damages. It allows courts to review personal injury damages for torts. Yeah, we covered what torts are, like personal injuries and shit like that. It allows all that. And tort reform's always been a hot button issue. A lot of big corporations like to push for it. Insurance carriers like to push for it. So Ron DeSantis signs this measure. Personal injury lawyers are pissed. And Morgan & Morgan, being one of the nation's largest personal injury firms, circulated an internal memo on March 24th to all of its attorneys. Now, we could guess what it says, right?
Be dicks.
It doesn't. We don't have to guess. You know why?
Did they publish it?
They gave it to every legal news outlet that asked.
Oh, my God.
So this is directly from their memo. Good morning, PI lawyers across the country. As we enter this new era, I want to make it unequivocally clear that we will not be giving an inch to carriers ever again. Not one inch. Specifically, as a matter of policy, we will not be granting any extensions of any sort moving forward for any reason. They can figure it out or file a motion. Under no circumstances will we be agreeing to any continuances, discovery extensions, or requests to extend deadline to answer complaints. Red line rules. It will be a serious internal offense if we find any courtesies being extended to the insurance industry, including cases filed prior to March. No discovery extensions, no matter the circumstances. We may want to help the human being defense attorney because we know them and maybe like them, but we will not because they work for an enemy who is heartless and ruthless. The enemy
Holy
who just... Yeah. Yeah. The enemy...
Holy
The enemy who just tried to kill us in Florida. They work for the enemy who would like nothing more but for you to be unemployed. We work for the people. Exclusively. They tried to take from the most vulnerable people and consequently your families. No extensions for responses to our complaints. If there are extenuating circumstances that would benefit our client only, please reach out to Matt or John Smith for prior approval. As a blanket rule, we will be giving not one single inch.
Holy shit.
Now, like 4 days later, the owner of the firm sent out, it goes without saying that all attorneys and team members are required to follow the rules of professional conduct and civil procedure in their state to the letter of the rule or law. Basically, so if there's a rule saying you can't be an asshole.
You can't.
Yeah, they can't do that, but.
That's incredible. Shots fired.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
That's one. Well, I know who I'm hiring.
Yeah, it's I read that. I'm like, holy shit.
That's, I see why that's your legal news. Yeah, that's way more interesting.
And we have one more piece of very important legal news from yesterday.
What's that?
It involves somebody who was very active on social media.
Oh, is this the indictment?
A judge who blocked a lawyer on Facebook can't be sued for a First Amendment violation.
What? Was that a question?
In Texas.
He blocked him on Facebook, and that was the... He blocked me on Facebook!
In Texas,
I want my money.
Judge Michael Newman, a probate judge, who used his Facebook to share news about his personal life and support his campaign for re-election, found his Facebook page being assaulted by an attorney named Randall Callinan, who alleged that the judge had court cronies that did favors and did favors for them at the expense of other litigants. So the judge, who is looking at his personal Facebook page, is like, yeah, like you're posting this on pictures of my grandkids at Disney. So he blocked the lawyer on Facebook. So the lawyer's response was to go out there and say, this is a First Amendment violation because the judge is a public figure. And, and therefore his Facebook page, because he used it for his campaigns, is a part of his official position. And he can't block
me
on
Facebook. We all just agree at this point, Facebook should never be have the word official anywhere in a sentence corresponding to it. Can we all just, as a country...
Now,
also, was this Supreme Court? Because you said this is a First Amendment violation. Did this make it to the U.S.
No,
Supreme Court?
No, this went to the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Now, interestingly enough, though, there is a case out there that's called like the Knight First Amendment Institute that specifically regarded this sort of issue that was in front of the Supreme Court. And
really,
in that case, a public official was using their official account for their position to block people on Twitter. And
so they weren't using a personal Twitter account. They were using
their official account.
Senator so-and-so.
Right. Right.
Okay.
And the court said, because we're looking at this and this account really is, it's not your personal account.
This is an
account you're using as a person in a government position. Right?
That makes a bit more sense. I mean, you can't if you're using it to announce things that are important to the mass, yeah, you shouldn't be able to block people with that. You shouldn't read any of the comments either. Both of us are on YouTube. We know not to read the comments, Posey.
Do you know what ended up happening? Who was blocking people?
Who?
Guess.
Oh, God, is it Trump?
It's Trump, motherfucker!
Indict him!
That's our Trump mention. And that's actually why, just to let you know, a lot, like after that came down, a lot of politicians started creating two accounts. One where they could just, but it's my personal account, but and another one for that was like representative so-and-so, senator so-and-so.
Yeah, okay.
And then they said, no, that's my official account over there. I don't block people on that one. On this one, I block motherfuckers.
I blocked everyone. I see nothing.
Oh, but that is your one Trump mention.
Yay.
That is it. So,
you know what? That, like I said, I went deep diving last night. I've had quite enough mentions of him. We're cool now. We're cool.
I love the fact that you went deep. Like, that's the blind leading the fucking blind. You and Zanny on a stream talking about the indictment and the legal ramifications.
Oh, God, no. We do not talk politics. Dude, you have to remember, I had a job where all I did all day was consume news, try to figure out how it was going to affect global markets. Now I'm just like, oh, the news is on my TV. Throw out the television. It has been tainted. Every once in a while, someone will message me like, did you hear what happened? And I just have a blanket statement. No, I did not. And I'm happier for it. They're like, your house is on fire. I'm like, I'll look into it.
Yeah, shit happens. Shit happens.
Blocked.
Shit happens. Fake news. Click.
Fake news.
So, I promised you some cartoon shit.
I'm so excited.
I promised you some cartoon shit. And I also, and you all don't know this, the last two episodes that I have done with Alkali have at some point veered into talking about dead bodies.
Yep.
And I told Alkali, no one dies in today's case.
Oh, man. Can we stay off the topic?
No, no one dies.
Of course we can.
No, there's no corpses. No corpses in today's case. No one dies. All right. Today's case is a wonderful case of what happens when a weird set of events comes together to make law, common law, that is known by lawyers all over the country. This is another one of those cases that every single attorney knows because we all fucking learn about it.
I like these. These are always interesting. Okay.
So we're going to go back 99 years. To Brooklyn in August of 1924.
Oh, okay.
All right. The case here is Paul's Graf v. Long Island Railroad Company. The citation is 162 NE 99, New York, 1928. This case was heard by the New York Court of Appeals, which is the New York version of the Supreme Court.
Okay.
All right. That's like, because the New York Supreme Court is actually their trial court.
At this point, I'm convinced that certain states just know about this podcast. So they're like, no, let's fuck with the legal layman.
Right.
There's no way he'll be able to understand this shit.
Right. Like, you hear New York Supreme Court and you're thinking, oh, no, I know about this. Boozy and I have talked about this. Those are the guys like at the top and they hear everything and they know all
New
this
York
shit.
Court.
And then it's like, you know, the Supreme Court. What's that? That's the trial court. Fuck! Not how it was supposed to go.
Can we just agree? At least naming conventions, at least the naming conventions of law should have some sort of rules. You know, like, what's another word for rule? A law! A law! Can we have a law?
So,
name shit the same way.
Their appeals court, though, what do you think the New York Appeals Court is named?
Oh, there's a Supreme Pizza.
No, it's the New York Supreme Court Appellate Division.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
And their version of the Supreme Court is just called the New York Court of Appeals.
Yeah. Yeah, they're making sure at this point that none of us could ever be a lawyer. Got it. All right, well done. Right. Well done.
So it's August of 1924. And Helen Paulsgraf, who is a janitor and a household cleaner type of person, like I forget the fucking name. They're a servant. They're like a rich person's maid. But there's a word for it that's not, you know, rich person's maid that I can't remember because yeah. So it's hot. They're in Brooklyn. They're in the city. And Helen looks at her two young daughters and says, "Children, let us go to the beach."
Okay.
So they go and they walk down to the Long Island Railroad Company station. And they are standing on the platform, for they are going to go to Rockaway Beach to beat the heat.
Okay.
All right.
Sounds like a nice day.
Right, they're standing there. One of her daughters walks off, Lillian, to buy some candy at a newspaper stand. And they're sitting there, and there's crowds. And two young men are getting ready to board a train. They have tickets for another train. And that train is starting to leave, and they're running late. So the train's starting to pull out of the station, and these two young men begin running after the train to get on it.
Okay.
So the railway employees see this happening. What do you think they do?
Well, you said the train is already in motion.
Right.
So hopefully hold out their hands and remind them that trains have doors and they probably shouldn't hold on to the side of an engine?
Oh, no, like they're helping the guys into a moving fucking train as it's pulling away from the station. Like one of them jumps into the car, turns around, and then, like, the railway guard is, like, trying to shove the other one through an open door as the train's moving.
God.
Now, let me ask, from this course of events, knowing that I have said this is a negligence case, what do you think happens?
I think the train is moving. The gentlemen are moving with it. The person trying to help him onto the train trips a little bit because it's a moving goddamn machine. And then the guy falls off and hits the kid.
Okay.
Falls onto the kid.
The man being helped into the train is holding a parcel.
Okay.
What do you think the lawsuit is concerning?
I still, because the lawsuit's from the mother and she's not part of this scenario yet. Yet being the operative term. So, parcel full of cocaine hits the ground, blows up everywhere. The kid who was just trying to smell the flowers takes a big inhale and now they've got a problem.
Well, the parcel was full of something and the parcel did fall.
Okay.
Okay. And then the parcel explodes.
Okay.
Like explodes.
Literal explodes.
Literal explosion.
The parcel was in one piece and then
it is described,
rapidly moved from that position.
Correct. It is described as about a 15-inch parcel wrapped in newspaper. The young man being helped up on the train drops it. It hits the ground, immediate explosion. Fire, loud bang, noise.
Was this what, old TNT? Did it revert back to nitroglycerin?
We'll get to that.
Fuck me, what?
So now, what do you think caused the negligence lawsuit?
I'm going to guess bringing unstable TNT onto a train, dropping it and blowing up a child. You said no corpses.
There are no corpses.
God.
Nobody dies.
Oh, I thought it was about to be a cadaver caveat.
Nobody dies.
I totally was waiting for the cadaver caveat.
Nobody dies, and you're wrong. The explosion does not hurt a child. The explosion does not hurt an adult. So why are we in a personal injury lawsuit?
Personal injury. The part that's killing me is injury. Did it blow the train off the track so the train taking him to the beach couldn't show up?
Nope.
Oh, deafened. Did it deafen the children?
Nope.
Okay, you got me. I'm going to just keep guessing nonsense.
An indeterminate distance called many feet away. The New York Times would later describe it as about 10 feet away from the explosion. Is a large, heavy, coin-operated scale.
Yeah,
like the ones you used to see in a bathroom where you would put something in and then you climb on and tell you what. You put a coin in and tell you what.
Okay. I can't imagine what this has to do with the lawsuit.
The explosion is strong enough to knock the scale over.
Oh, God.
At which point it hits Helen Paulsgraf.
Ooh, those things are heavy as shit.
All right. Now, here's the good news. Helen does not have to go to the hospital.
Good.
All right. A taxi driver takes her home. However, a few days later,
say she weighs more, I'm leaving.
She develops a stammer.
Oh, visual representation of the injury.
There we go. I was waiting for it. So what is the injury? The injury is the trauma of the explosion and the scale hitting her manifesting itself in the form of a stammer.
Yes! Go, Helen! 9 out of 10 Helen's degree.
I am like a proud papa because the first episode with corpses.
The first episode with corpses. I like that we have to number these now.
The first episode with corpses was specifically about how the law deals with mental anguish and injuries to the psyche and things like that. And one of the old rules that didn't really start getting changed till the 50s, the 60s, 70s was in order to recover for a mental injury, you had to have some form of a physical manifestation of it that could be linked to it.
This is that. Ah.
So to hear Alkali just jump right on, oh, the stammer, she was traumatized. She's suing for the trauma.
Yay!
So this is why
I'm a lawyer now.
This is why I say this is some Looney Tunes shit. Because think about this series of events. Oh, we can make it even better. The news articles written about this injury describe the two men as Italian in appearance. Don't know why it's important. It apparently was important enough to mention.
They're presenting as Italian. I get it. All right, all right.
And speculated that their box of fireworks must have been something they were taking to some Italian celebration. Now, I don't know. Maybe there is like a folk festival in August that people of Italian descent are involved with. But think about the news reports like, the two Italians were running for a train and dropped their box of Italian explosives for their Italian festival.
I used to have a pyrotechnics license.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, what the hell were they carrying that degraded down to nitroglycerin?
No clue.
How old were these fireworks?
No clue, but actually during the trial, one of the witnesses from the platform said the shock of the explosion did not just knock over the scale, which once again, at least 10 feet away from the explosion was this scale.
Holy shit.
But referred to it as having been blown to pieces.
Oh my God. Yeah, dude, I don't know how fireworks worked back in the 1920s, but that genuinely sounds like some aerials that were using basically TNT that degraded back down to nitroglycerin. Those were very old, very large fireworks.
So Miss Pawsgraf sues, very obviously. She sues.
Yeah.
It goes to trial, and this is where shit gets even more Looney Tunes. All right.
Okay.
The railroad is being sued for negligence. Now, in a past episode, you and I went over the elements of negligence, right?
Right.
You have to owe somebody a duty of care.
Okay.
Right? And you determine you determine that duty of care by looking at what could reasonably happen, who could reasonably be injured. You have to breach that duty of care. All right. You have to fail to act in a manner that would prevent the injury. Right. There has to be an injury that results, and the injury has to arise from your breach. It has to be caused by your breach, right?
Okay, so I could see the argument for the four of those, but now I have a different question.
Yeah.
She went after the railroad company and not the two gentlemen.
Correct, because remember, it was a railroad company employee helping the two gentlemen on the train, right?
Agreed. I see the four, and is that why they went after the railroad? Because it was easier to... Because we are at the time period where they still need all four of those. Those four are necessary for the case right now.
Nope.
No. What is necessary in this time period?
The only things necessary is the railroad breached a duty of care.
Okay.
And she was injured. That's it.
They only need
those
two.
That's all they need. Those two. They don't have to go into, are you in the class of person that could be expected to be injured, any of that.
And I'm not saying she didn't do this. Did she also sue the two of them? Because if those are the only two quicklaries, they had an explosive package that was detonated upon impact. To me, that's almost a more solid case. Why is it not? There's my question.
Because think about it. Okay. say the railroad owes a duty of care, obviously, to the two people they are helping onto the fucking train, right?
Agreed. Yes.
And injuries. A duty of care isn't just owed to a person. You can also owe it to prevent injury to their possessions.
Agreed.
So helping these two guys on the train, say the railroad assumed a duty of care to do so in a responsible manner to prevent injury to these two guys, right?
Okay.
They breached that because now their package is damaged.
Right.
Okay. She would still meet the test. The railroad owed a duty of care that was breached, and she was injured as a result of it.
Okay. Okay. Did the two Italians sue over there?
No.
Over there?
No, the two bomb-carrying Italians decide to let it fucking go.
Smart men. Smart men.
An additional thing. Under New York law at the time, railroads owed not only a duty of care to their passengers, but a duty of utmost care, the highest level of care to their passengers.
Is that still a thing?
Yeah. Yeah, you can owe a very high duty of care still.
What is that, like flight or pilots?
Yeah, like okay. Common carriers is what they call. What
okay,
call,
cool. Right? All right, that makes sense. All right, so there's a higher level of standard that they have to reach.
So here's a question. These two guys were riding the Long Island Railroad Company, right?
Okay.
They weren't going to Rockaway Beach. They were on a different train. But Helen Pausgraf was also a passenger on the Long Island Railroad Company to go to Rockaway Beach.
But they share the same platform.
It's the same company.
Yeah.
So,
oh God, was that their defense?
So what level?
She wasn't getting on that train.
No, it wasn't. What level of care would Long Island Railroad Company, under what I've told you, have owed to Helen Pausgraf as a passenger of the Long Island Railroad Company in this situation?
Not to be the group that's inadvertently set off a small bomb?
Absolutely fucking none. The railroad's duty of utmost care to its passengers only applied on the train, not the platform, and nowhere else in the station.
Really?
Yeah. This was all New York precedent at the time, so it goes to trial. And there's testimony on this. The railroad sends its lawyer out there who does a bang-up job. I mean, he just does a wonderful job. He does such a good job at trial that the jury only deliberates for 2 hours and 35 minutes before returning a verdict. And that is 2 hours and 35 minutes, including the lunch hour.
Holy shit.
And they return the verdict, as you would expect, in favor of
the train.
No, Helen.
Yeah!
The railroad sent the most junior member of their legal team to defend this.
Really?
He called no witnesses. His entire trial strategy was try to get the case dismissed.
And that no backup. Just
no backup.
Oh,
that was
I hope they throw it out. I hope they throw it out. I hope they throw it out. Damn it.
Years later, Judge Richard Posner, who is a legal legend. You've actually probably heard Judge Posner's name because he sat on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals out there in Illinois for a very long time before retiring about 6-7 years ago.
Oh, no shit. That's awesome.
Yeah, we've considered Posner one of the preeminent legal scholars of our age. Referred to this as a bargain basement defense.
Right.
So
throw out the case, please.
So the jury comes back and they award Helen $6,000 in 1924 dollars. So that's
give me a number.
Little under $100,000 today, about $93,000 really? Today.
Very cool.
Plus,
all right,
plus
Helen.
The cost of the action.
9 out of 10 Helens are amused.
So this gets appealed first to the Intermediate Appeals Court, and the Intermediate Appeals Court upholds the verdict. All right? And when they uphold the verdict, they are looking at the concept of proximate cause. All right?
Proximate cause.
Proximate cause.
Now, really quick, before you go into proximate cause, because this guy is a bargain basement, he didn't bring up a lot during the trial,
right.
So there's not a lot to appeal, right?
Right. Like, his main grounds on appeal are the law doesn't support a verdict in her favor.
Right.
We didn't know her duty. We're not responsible for the injury.
Okay.
That's more or less the entirety of it. It's all based
he brought up.
That's all that can be addressed on appeal.
Okay. Right. I'm following you. Now, what's this new one?
Proximate cause. There's a great way to describe it. All right. And this way it's the same thing that the intermediate court in New York, looking at Ms. Paulsgraf's case when the railroad appealed it, looked at the matter. And it's called the Squibb case.
Squibb?
Squibb. What's a squib? You're an explosives guy. What's a squib?
Yeah. Squib is a body mod. You put a small explosive with something behind it, and you can pop things off. We use them on stage all the time.
Right. It's a little explosive. And they've had squibs for hundreds of years.
They used to be air pressurized. They're great.
And you could light them, and they're just tiny little explosions. Just tiny little explosions.
Yeah.
Not enough to kill somebody, not to call, but
yeah.
Boom. That's it. All right. So the Squibb case. This is Scott v. Shepard. Its citation is 96 English Reporter 525 from the King's Bench in 1773.
We're going back to 1773 here.
We're going back to 1773.
I fucking love the law. What the fuck? Okay, 1773. They knew everything.
Right.
Got it.
So, some guy named Shepard is at his local market in Merry Old England in 1773, and he sees all the people in the crowded market, and Shepard, he's a bit of a devil. He's a bit of a prankster. He likes to make the jollies and the japes, you know?
So he packaged some explosives and gave them to Italians that do not bring them out until 1924.
He pulls out a squib. Don't know why he was walking around to the local market with a squib in his hand, but he had one. He lit it, and he threw it into the fucking crowd. It lands by the butcher.
Okay.
The butcher picks it up because he looks down and goes, oh shit, that's an explosive.
Picks it
up and throws it. That lands by the baker.
Oh, God.
The baker looks down, says, oh, shit, that's an explosive. Picks it up and throws it. It lands by the candlestick maker.
Oh, God. The
candlestick maker looks down, says, oh, God, that's an explosive. Picks it up and throws it. It lands next to a guy named Shepard. Shepard goes, oh, God, that's an explosive. Picks it up, pulls back to throw it, and then it blows up.
How bad?
Put his eye out.
How bad?
No, put his eye out. It blew.
Oh, put his eye out.
The man lost an eye.
You know, I've had a squib go off in my hand before, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
that's how my thumb lost skin. It peeled. Those are no fucking joke. Oh my God. My God.
So, Scott sues Shepard.
Okay.
Right. He's lost an eye. He's pissed. He's going to sue somebody. And he goes after the candlestick. The candlestick. No, this thing just landed next to me. I threw it. The baker, this thing just landed next to me, I threw it. The butcher, this thing just landed next to me, I threw it. They get it all the way back to Shepard, who initially threw it into the crowd.
They actually figured that out
in
the 1700s?
They figured it out in the 1700s, who threw it.
Oh, I wouldn't think they could do that without Reddit. Well done.
So Scott sues Shepard for his injuries, and Shepard's defense was, I didn't throw it at him. I threw it in the crowd.
You started the chain reaction.
And that is exactly why Shepard had to pay.
Yeah, okay.
Because the court looked at it and said, no, This is a proximate cause. You threw it into a crowd. The natural and probable result of it landing next to somebody is they're going to try to get a fucking explosive away from them. So yeah. We're not going to let you say, well, you should sue the butcher, the baker, or the candlestick maker, because they're the ones who threw it at you. We're going to go all the way back and say the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker all acted naturally. It was a natural and probable and foreseeable result. We're bringing it back to you. You are the proximate cause. Your action is the proximate cause. Whereas what Shepard was arguing was novus actus interveniens.
Novus actus interveniens. So the action was not my fault.
It was a new intervening act. The injury didn't result from my act. It resulted from a new act that intervened in my act. All right.
The courts were saying those acts wouldn't have happened unless you started this.
These are not new intervening acts. They are natural and probable results of your act. A new intervening act would be like, you know, I lock you out of your house. Okay. And you're trying to climb in and you fall, you break your leg. All right, maybe I'm responsible because me locking you out or something could be approximately cause you to try to climb and get in. Maybe that's natural and probable. It's for a court to decide. But if I lock you out of your house and then an airplane plummets out of the fucking sky and slams into you, that is a new intervening act. It is not a natural and probable result of me locking you out of your house.
Okay.
All right. So the intermediary appellate court in New York looked at all this and said, well, no, wait a second. Somebody was getting on a train with a package. You assisted them. Maybe you shouldn't have assisted them, but you breached your duty of care in doing that and helping them on negligently, and they dropped the package, it exploded, that explosion knocked something over on the platform, and that thing on the platform that got knocked over by the explosion injured this woman. It is a natural and probable result. Your negligence in assisting that person on the train is what caused the package to drop, which caused the explosion, which caused the scales to fall, which caused Helen Stammer.
I love it. I love it.
So the railroad appeals it up again. This time to the New York Court of Appeals.
They're just not getting this game of connect the dots. They got to go with it.
Right. So there they are. Same idea. Same appeal grounds. And this time it is being heard by Justice Benjamin Cardozo, who would later go on to sit on the United States Supreme Court.
Okay.
All right. Cardozo strips out all the extraneous facts. He strips out the gentlemen are Italian, which, yeah, like,
good for him.
Probably he shouldn't be considering that. His name's Cardozo.
The thunder's starting, dude.
Oh, God.
Holy shit. It sounds awesome out here.
So his name's Cardozo. So obviously the first thing he's like, yeah, we're not going to reference the fact they're fucking Italian. My name is Cardozo. This does not matter to me.
Nice.
All right. And he goes through the whole thing and proximate cause, and he talks about that, and he's going through the dropping of the package and everything, and he does what?
He agrees with everything that's been stated and awards her $6,000?
Holds for the railroad.
Why?
The modern standard of negligence is you owe a duty of care to those who are within the zone of danger. A foreseeable risk.
10 feet away.
Not only that, they owed a duty, obviously, to the people they were helping on the train. That's a foreseeable risk. That's something that you know, if I fuck up doing this, this person will be hurt. They even owed a duty to the guy for his package. That's a foreseeable risk. He's holding a package. Okay. All right. However, what was the package wrapped in?
Newspaper.
What does newspaper not have written on it?
Fragile.
No. Explosive. Fireworks inside.
They couldn't have known.
How could the guard have known that it created a risk? And if the guard couldn't have known that that package hitting the ground would cause it to explode or potentially explode and injure other people on the platform, how could Helen have been in the zone of danger? How could the risk to her have been foreseeable to the railroad?
Okay, I definitely understand what you're saying. You're not assuming that any random package could explode to the point where a 10-foot radius... Okay, I get it. Yeah.
Now, Cardozo goes even further. He says the guard could have taken the package from the passenger, held it over his head, and threw it to the ground and not been liable.
Because he had no way of knowing what the hell he would...
Because the lack of foreseeability meant that he would have no way of knowing Helen was in the zone of danger and therefore owed the duty of care. So even if the railroad was negligent, which remember, at the very beginning of telling the story, at that time, the law was they owed a duty that was breached. I was injured. That's it. They didn't have to owe you the duty. They just had to owe a duty that was breached and you're injured as a result of it. And the proximate cause linked. They didn't have to owe you the duty, just someone a duty.
Oh, shit.
Cardozo's ruling was, no, they've got to owe you the duty. You have to be within the zone of danger. You have to be part of the foreseeable risk. And if you're not, then you cannot collect for negligence.
Oh, brutal. And this is the highest court in New York.
This is the highest court. So, like, if the package had been labeled explosives, or if the Italian... If the Italian gentleman holding the package turned around and said, hey, the package, it'll go boom if you drop.
It'll go boom if you drop.
Yeah, maybe that would have changed it. But on the facts here, a nondescript package falling out of a passenger's arm, yeah, they owed a duty of care to the guy they were helping on the train. And yeah, they breached the duty of care to him. But they didn't owe Helen a duty of care because she's outside of the zone of danger.
Holy shit.
Now...
Oh, 9 out of 10 Helens disagree now.
Now, there is a dissent in this. There's judges on the court who disagree. And Justice Andrews writes the dissent. So Andrews believes that doesn't matter who you owe the duty of care to, the fact that you breached it and your breach caused an injury via proximate cause is enough. Now, it's a close decision. It actually is, because you got to remember, the proximate cause idea, that had been the law for a long period of time. This idea that if you breach a duty of care owed to somebody, and someone's injured, and your breach is the proximate cause of that injury, it doesn't matter whether you owed a duty of care to that person. That was law for a long time. So Cardozo's thing of, no, you're only liable if they are foreseeably within the zone of danger... is new. That's a whole new thing, all right?
Oh, okay.
Right? So the decision is 4-3 in favor of the Long Island Railroad Company.
Oh, my God.
4-3. The best way to explain this is, because you get the idea of the duty of care, all right, and foreseeable risk. And here's the one that, here's the quote that kind of goes into Cardozo's view and explains it. Negligence cannot impose liability where an intentional act does not. So if I punch Tom, my intentional act makes me liable. But if I punch Tom and Tom stumbles backwards and knocks a sword into Mary, I haven't done anything to Mary. My intent to punch Tom doesn't transfer to Mary. Now, could I foresee that that would happen? Maybe. But if I couldn't, And I punch Tom, and Mary has a heart attack and dies from the shock of seeing Tom get punched. How does me punching Tom have anything with Mary?
And that's what this guy's
saying. That's what he's
saying.
Negligence accidental... can, yeah, negligence cannot impose liability where an intentional act would not. If I had picked up that package and it had plates in it and I threw it on the ground, my intentional act of throwing the plates on the ground wouldn't make me liable to Miss Paulsgraf.
Oh my God.
And one of the reasons Cardozo does this, one of the reasons he's going with that is, and this is fun, is he's saying proximate cause is going to be too difficult to figure out. Now, never mind the fact that at that point they've been doing it for almost 200 years, but proximate cause is too difficult to figure out. When do we stop getting to the point where it's the cause of this? When is it so attenuated? When is the injury so remote from the initiating action that it can no longer be proximate cause? That's part of his reasoning behind that. This is a better test. They're within the zone of danger, and those are the only people that you can owe a duty to, are the people that are foreseeably within the zone of danger.
I mean, Right? Okay, I definitely get the logic on it. Yeah, I'm following that.
All right. Whereas proximate cause, in Cardozo's view, could go on forever. It's like the domino effect thing. Yeah, you ever seen that meme of the tiny domino with the big domino?
Yeah.
Now imagine there's a bunch of shit that's a Rube Goldberg situation. Does me flicking the marble really cause the balloon to pop?
So you're basically saying that because there's no way to go down this rabbit hole this far, they decided to stop doing it.
That at some point, you got to cut it off. However, Andrews, in his dissent, has a response. Water from a river. If a muddy stream goes into a river, for a while, you still see the streaks of mud in the river, and you can tell that water over there, that's from that stream. If a salty stream goes in, for a while, the water's still really salty, and you can go, that water over there, that's from the salty stream. Now, obviously, there's a point where you're not able to identify it anymore.
Yeah, okay.
So that's Andrew's response, which is, of course we can limit it. We just have to take it to its rational conclusion. And the moment that there's shit that's not rational or it's obvious something else has happened to cause that result, we stop. Everything up to that point, everything up to the rational conclusion, that's where proximate cause ends.
Right? And that also makes sense. With a 4-3 vote, that's
brutal.
With a 4-3
vote. Now, in general, the vast majority of states hold on to proximate cause for a while. A minority starts accepting Cardozo's foreseeable risk view. What ends up happening, though, is an overwhelming majority of states over time sort of hybrid the two. They basically kind of say, we're going to go with proximate cause to determine who you owe a duty to. Almost like foreseeable risk, but not really. But what's a natural chain of events, so that foreseeable portion, and who do you owe a duty to, but not necessarily who has the right. You still got to owe somebody a duty, but we're going to expand the group of people that you owe a duty to. That's the current state now, is now you got to look out to a certain point, and like at the end of where you could rationally see, like outside a zone of danger, but rational foreseeability, and that's kind of the end. They kind of merge those two together a bit. There are some states that do follow strict proximate cause. Wisconsin does. And there are some states that follow strict foreseeable risk. But most states kind of blend the two a little bit, and the third restatement of torts actually reflects that now.
I love it. I love it. Well, that is wild.
And it would not be a legal funhouse if I didn't tell you how the appeal went afterwards.
Okay, so they did appeal again.
No, there was no other appeal. But after the appeal, remember, the court reversed. Miss Paul's graph had won $6,000, about $100,000 at the trial court. The first appeal had upheld that verdict. The second appeal overturned it.
Okay.
And she was ordered to pay costs to the railroad.
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah. She was ordered to pay $559.60 in 1928 dollars to the Long Island Railroad Company for the costs of the multiple appeals.
Fuck off. That's a thing?
Yeah. I'm not sure what that comes to today, but considering like $6,000 was equal to like $100,000 today.
Oh my God.
Like, yeah, what? Yeah.
That's gotta be 15 and 20,000.
Yeah. And remember, she's a janitor and a housekeeper in Brooklyn.
What the fuck
with
is going on?
Not only that, but as a result of the trauma and stammer, she can no longer work.
The 1900s suck.
She dies in 1945 at the age of 61, living with her daughter in horrible health. She has gone mute by this time. She spends the remainder of her life embittered, angrier than shit about this.
I mean, I would be too.
Now, remember, this injury happened in 1924. She dies at the age of 61 in 1945. She was 40 years old when all this happened.
Oh my God.
She spends 20 years angrier than shit. So angry, so traumatized. She's mute. She can't talk. She's infirm. She dies early.
Dude.
However. This case is immediately latched on by law schools because of the writing and because of the unique nature of it. It becomes one of those cases that is very good to teach young lawyers about a concept because it's engaging. It really is just a series of cartoon fuck, like two Italian guys running after a train. One of them drops a box. He's like, "My linguine." It blows up, knocks scales over on an old lady. They reference a case where some guy throws a fucking squib into a 1770s English market and blows a man's eye out.
Oh my God.
You know, people are paying attention to this. And lawyers everywhere begin learning it. Her in 1978.
Okay.
Her grandson, Frank, is called for jury duty. And when his name is mentioned, the prosecutor and the judge ask if he has a relation to Helen Paulsgraf. And when he says yes, he is treated like a celebrity by the court.
Oh my God. Is this the first time he heard that?
No. They have been aware of that. Like, come on. Like, they probably knew that this was going around law schools, but that's when he found out, like, what a big deal it was about lawyers. Because, like, this was discussed for decades, like, almost immediately after Cardozo's ruling came down. It immediately started getting discussed. Not only discussed, but debated in legal circles.
Wow. Okay.
All right. The entire family apparently has taken great enjoyment out of being so well known with legal notoriety, with the exception of Helen. Helen did not enjoy it.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it.
Right. And here's the life is fucked up coda. In 1991, a first cousin of Justice Benjamin Cardozo, four times removed, but a first cousin, four times removed, from Justice Benjamin Cardozo, married a gentleman from New York who was Paul Graf's great-grandson.
Come on!
Yep!
That's fucking insane. Oh, it had to be because they were so big in that circle. They started hanging out with lawyers. That's what happens. You start marrying them.
So we're not getting married.
Damn it. That would have solved so many of my legal problems.
Immediately, you say that, I'm like, no, that's not happening.
I am a lawyer. I'm not your lawyer. And if we're married, fuck off, Alkali. I'm still not helping you. Too many lawsuits.
So small fucking world. The Paulsgraf and Cardozo family. Like, do you think they knew? Or do you think it was later? Because obviously it's known now if I'm talking about it. But do you think, like, at the time they met, they knew? Like, oh,
I think so.
Your cousin really fucked over my great-grandma. She died penniless, crippled, and mute.
Well, that you said she was so angry. It's like, oh, man, I'm so sorry. Nah, she was mean. She was a mean mute.
She learned sign language. What did she say? Fuck a lot. She told us to go fuck herself a lot in sign language.
All the time.
Just all the fucking time.
Anytime I was walking through the house with my $6,000 on a leash, she would get so angry.
Like every time she saw a firework or an Italian, just hands flying.
We served pasta during Easter dinner once before. There were no survivors.
I mean, but yeah. So that is the tale of Paulsgraf v. Long Island Railroad Company and how we got the competing views of foreseeable risk versus proximate cause and the terms and the way of defining how you breach and who you owe a duty of care to.
That's amazing. That's actually an insanely interesting one. I wish it ended better for Helen, but that's incredibly interesting.
And like I promised, no corpse.
No corpses.
No corpses.
No corpses. No,
not a single fucking corpse.
Which is surprising if the level of explosive could move one of those heavy ass scales. But like, it had to be dropped right next to the Italians and the conductor.
No, it was 10 feet away. It was 10 feet away. Yeah, like, right? And there's actually, like, debate about that, because you can only, when you're talking about these, you can only go based on the facts that are determined at trial, right?
Right.
All right, so, like, Ramon, I'm going, here's the facts. These are the facts that are determined at trial. Realistically, there have been, like, people saying, you know, there's no way a tiny box of explosives blew up with enough force to knock a heavy-ass scale onto a woman 10 feet away. And that's when people are like, well, you know, like maybe people panicked when an Italian dropped something that exploded, because this was the 20s. It was right at the beginning of the anarchist movements and the workers' movements, when they were violent at that point in time. And immigrants, Italians, Germans were big in those movements. So maybe somebody saw an Italian guy carrying a nondescript box that then blew the fuck up and everyone panicked.
And
that's how the sails got knocked over. But as a matter of law, that box exploded with enough force to knock the scale over.
I understand what you... I'm also sitting here like the concussive force of that should have killed the people who dropped it, because it had to drop next to them.
Well, no, you see, they were on the train at that point in time. They were moving away from the explosion.
Oh my god,
they were shielded.
What a wild story! What a wild story!
Right,
right. That's crazy.
Oh, I love the fact, by the way, because it's nice to be able to say something like, and then she developed a stammer. You're like, because she had to have a physical manifestation of trauma to sue for it. And I'm like, you've learned something.
I'm slowly getting it. After on episode 100, I'm going to be like, oh, that's a tort. Yes. And then I will bring out my pie. It'll be.
That'll be it. The moment your pie comes out on camera, we're done.
That's right.
No more episodes. I'm just going to stop it right there. No more episodes. Alkali has brought out the pie of completion.
The pie of completion. God. Oh, man. Great one, dude. Great one. Oh, what a fucked up thing. I feel so bad for her.
Right.
You said, what appeal was that? The fourth one is where she got fucked?
No, that was the second appeal. The third time a court considered the matter, the second appeal.
Oh, my God. Yeah, here's $100,000. No, sorry. Now that we're done, you owe us $15,000.
Like, yeah, and doesn't that suck, though? Because, like, you know, I won two out of three. The first time they took 2.5 hours it only took 2.5 hours to decide my case, and it only took that long because they had lunch.
My God.
Yo, come on. They didn't even call any fucking witnesses in their trial. You're gonna give them money?
That is wild. I can't believe they made them pay for the
right now. Now, if it makes you feel better, which, like, in perspective, it probably shouldn't make you feel better because of the reason. But the railroad never saw a penny of that $500+. I don't know how good it is, because the reason they never saw a penny of that $500+ is, as I stated, Helen Paulsgraf was not able to work anymore and the family was destitute.
Fuck, dude, that is so fucked up. But, is that still a thing now? Do we have to pay for appeals when they go through?
A court can order it. It's not amazingly common for a court to order it, but it can happen.
Okay.
Like, if it's an improvidently taken appeal or something like that, yeah. Most of the time, though, we work under what's called the American rule, which is everybody pays, unless the statute or the law allows for it, everybody bears their own costs.
Okay.
So, but yeah. Yeah, so that is the story of Helen Paulsgraf, the two Italian gentlemen, the exploding package, the falling scales, and the Long Island Railroad Company.
Rube Goldberg would be proud and broke.
Fucking, it's like a Looney Tunes episode.
It genuinely is. Yeah. That's a wild one.
So if you enjoy this, everyone, please feel free to support Boozy's Legal Funhouse. You can go to our patreon.com/lawyersandliquor. And as always, support Alkali, our certified legal layman. Alkali, where can they do that at?
You can find me over on twitch.tv, Alkali and Zanny, all spit out Zanny with an X. We have a stream coming up this Saturday, April 1st, and it's going to be a completely normal stream.
I love the fact that you're advertising that right now, because point of order, this episode does not come out till Monday. So you had an episode last Saturday on April 1st that was a completely normal stream.
Totally normal stream. In that case, join us Sundays 11:30 a.m. for Sunday morning brunch once a week. There. Ha. I win.
And folks, if you like Boozy's Legal Funhouse, do me a favor. Run on over to your podcasting service of choice. Leave us 5 stars. You can say whatever you want. Tell me to go fuck myself. Tell Alkali he looks pretty. We don't care. Just like, leave a 5-star review so that we can get more eyes on this shit. And until next time, also forgive the fucked up editing. I know at the beginning I said, like, I don't edit, but the stream cut out in the middle of it. And considering I use the recordings of the stream to do the audio, there's going to be some editing on this one.
Just a little. It's a fast. Come on, man. Scissors and tape. Cut and paste.
Yeah,
you got
there
this.
You go. It really is. That's why I clapped, motherfucker.
It's the best.
So I hope you'll
forgive. I did AV work back in the fucking early 2000s. I still remember having to splice things together by hand. Like, no, fuck that shit. We got 2 VCRs and a splitter. It was the greatest day in my high school.
Oh,
like,
yes. And that will be it for this week's episode of Boozy's Legal Funhouse. I hope to see you next time for episode 31. And until then, I'm Boozy.
I'm Alkali.
You all have a wonderful rest of your day.
Have a good one, everyone.